This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Betty Page was a 1950s pinup queen. She posed for men's magazines and for photos and films for private collectors with a taste for leather corsets, whips, black-seamed stockings, and stiletto-heeled shoes. She's been called the first official pinup of the bondage scene. Her pictures were considered in a 1955 Senate investigation into the impact of pornographic material on youth. She gave up modeling 2 years later and was born again. Her popularity has grown over the years. The mysteries and contradictions of her life are explored in the new movie, The Notorious Betty Page, which stars Gretchen Mol. My guest Mary Harron directed the film. She also made I Shot Andy Warhol and American Psycho and has directed episodes of Homicide, Oz, 6 Feet Under, and Big Love. In this scene from the film, Page is posing for photos by Paula and Irving Claw, who run a specialty business. They've asked her to wear black underwear, black seamed stockings, and stiletto heels so extreme that she can't walk without assistance. Paula Claw is played by Lily Taylor.
It's the shoes they want.
Shoes and boots, boots and shoes. I can't get enough of them.
Why?
Don't ask. Takes all types to make a world.
What kind of types?
You see, the customers who want this stuff, they're very respectable, very high-quality people. Doctors, lawyers, diplomats, even a judge. They're not people like us. The pressures they've got, they're not your average Joe. So what if they want something that seems a little strange, right? If it makes them happy.
Sure.
Sometimes they come into the store and I can see they want something different. Irving says I can spot them a mile off.
Oh, she can. She's got an instinct.
If I think it's shoes they want, I'll pull out a movie star. Lana Turner, let's say, with a nice pair of high heels. And I'll point to them and say, something like this, maybe. Oh, the look on their face, like they're so relieved, I understand. And then I start pulling out the special stuff.
Mary Harron, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe the kind of photos and short films that made Betty Page famous?
Well, there are two world Betty Page photographs. One are very sunny, traditional pinups. In, you know, bathing suits or bikinis and, you know, kind of jokey, lighthearted. And the other things that made her famous are these fetish photographs that she did for a brother and sister team called Irving and Paula Claw. And these are kind of grainy black and white. And it was seeing these photographs that first kind of inspired my interest in her, because she'll be standing in what looks like somebody's living room, suburban living room, you know, next to a lamp and a table and a chair. And then she's wearing like high heel leather boots and leather corsets. And she's always, you know, some kind of maybe a whip. But she's always smiling radiantly, you know, completely like she's Betty Crocker. She has a completely kind of inappropriate expression for these seemingly sinister photos. So those are the two worlds of Betty Page.
Yeah. In fact, you know, I confess I just bought a DVD of The Real Betty Page at a used record store. And so I was watching some of these films you were just describing with in front of the little lamp and the little table where she's dancing. And it's almost like she's doing a Charleston and a shimmy. You know, I mean, it's...
Yeah.
In all this fetish gear. It's, yeah.
Yes. I mean, wait. I mean, it's really only the fetish gear, or occasionally she will, you know, spank someone kind of ineffectually, or they might do a little bit of wrestling, her and another girl, always girls, never men in the photos. But apart from that, her demeanor really is of another world. So that's, I think, part of what gives these photos their strange appeal. On the other hand, I think that her affect when she's posing isn't really sexy. It isn't about trying to be sexy. It is the joy of being photographed. It's a kind of very innocent, playful, radiantly happy quality that comes out of the photographs, as if she's a kid dressing up.
Where were her photos published?
Well, when she made them in the early to mid-50s, they were done for private clients who would – the fetish photographs, I mean. And the fetish photographs would be taken in the Claw studio and – you know, the client would pay for the photographs. He would bring in the very expensive leather outfits. And then they would be for his private collection. Later, some of these were put together in little special editions, you know, Betty Page in Bondage. And the other photographs she did were kind of for the pinup. There were all these pinup magazines with names like Wink, you know, Titter, Flirt. And these were sold on newsstands, and they had a kind of ambiguous status because men would buy them, but then they would keep them under the bed or hide them in the garage. So they were sort of naughty but not, you know, illegal.
What was your first reaction seeing her photos, and how, if at all, has that reaction to those photos changed?
I think my first reaction was just like, who is this? Where are these photos come from, you know? Because they are kind of erotic. They're strange. You know, there's obviously a darkness because they're this gritty black and white, and because of the fetish content. At the same time, they're so cheery. It just, you know, nothing makes sense, which is kind of Betty herself. You know, she doesn't quite add up as a person. And the more you find out about her, every piece of the puzzle just makes it more mysterious.
Well, you portray Betty Page in your movie as someone who wanted to act but didn't seem to have quite the right talent for theater. But she really came alive doing these erotic poses in front of the camera. I mean, she really came alive. She blossomed. She loved it. Do you see her, you know, in all these kink poses as being like a victim of male lust or somebody who really found her calling?
I would go on the direction of that she really found her calling. I think she was a victim of male lust sometimes in her early life, in her personal life. You know, she had bad sexual experiences. You know, she was abused by her father. She had a very bad rape experience. You know, I think she had was someone who had experienced real sexual violence. And so I think if you have had those experiences, to be paid a lot of money just to dress up in costumes with a group of friends, it does not feel like victimization. I don't think it felt like that to her.
Now, in order to make this movie, you had to, in some way, enter the world of fetishists and understand that world so that you could portray them. Do you feel like you understand fetishes for bondage and for stiletto lace-up boots? I mean, one of the Betty Page specialty items were these incredibly high stiletto shoes and boots.
No, it's interesting because there's only a couple of real fetishists in the film. Because Irving and Paula, you know, I think were almost as clueless as Betty and Pat in the sense that they knew that these were for sexual purposes, but they, you know, kind of didn't interest them. They were just wanting to make money and run their business. There's a character called John Willie, who was a real life character played by Jared Harris, who was a really brilliant British artist and photographer who did illustrated stories about young women being, you know, they're very kind of tongue-in-cheek about a young woman named Gwendolyn being tied up by some evil aristocrat. And then he also did a magazine called Bizarre. And Bizarre, you can learn about fetishism from Bizarre. I don't think you can really learn anything about the appeal of fetishism from the Irving and Paula Claw photos because they're kind of clueless. You know, they don't think they understand the erotic content. But when you see John Willie's photographs, you're looking at women through a fetishist's eye. The true fetishist is so obsessive. It's so much about detail. It's so much about the height of the high heel, the length of the stocking top, you know, the number of, you know, laces in the boots. And it is a kind of transference of sexuality, so that the most potent part of the sexuality gets transferred on to high heels, vinyl, rubber boots, you know. I mean, it can be all kinds of things.
There are shots of Betty Page, like the real Betty Page, that are just like her legs and her feet with those shoes on. I mean, that's what I guess the guys wanted to see, the people who were really into those shoes.
Yes, as Lily Taylor says in the film, playing Paula Claw, it's shoes and boots and shoes. That's all they care about. It was just something we said constantly on the set. It was our little catchphrase. Things like a high heel fetish seem pretty harmless today, I have to say. Or it certainly seems to me, if somebody wants, you know, to be obsessed with high heels or stocking tops, that's entirely up to them. But I think what the Senate were worried about and the forces of morality generally was an idea that fetishism can be created, that if somebody sees a fetish photograph, it is a kind of infection, and that they, you know, a young person, an impressionable young person, that a fetish can be created in them simply by viewing this material.
One of the things you depict in the movie are these camera clubs where a group of men who are amateur photographers and into pinups would come together in, you know, and gather in a group and photograph Betty Page or another model. And I don't know whether they had to pay a fee to do this or what, but then they'd be able to take home their photographs and use them however they pleased. What were these camera clubs like, and how did you find out about them?
The photographers did pay a fee, so it was actually very profitable for the models. I first found out about the camera clubs from these fanzines, the Betty Pages, because Greg Theakston, the editor of those magazines, basically interviewed anybody who ever walked across Betty Page's path. And he put us in touch with a lot of, you know, as many photographers as we could talk to who are still alive. And, you know, again, you know, what is racy in the 50s is so innocuous today. I mean, today people make, you know, porno movies at home, you know, on home video equipment. But there to go and you'd pay a substantial amount of money to go and photograph a girl in lingerie. And some people would not even have film in the cameras. They would just pretend to take photographs. So exciting was it to be in the same room as a very curvy girl in underwear.
What was the casting process like for you? And one of the things I'm thinking of is that there are so many actresses today who are leading lady kind of actresses who are so thin. And they'd be all wrong for Betty Page, because not that Betty Page was heavy, but she had a figure. She had a bosom. She had hips. She had a kind of hourglass figure. And if you had somebody who looked kind of anorexic with their clothes off, as I think probably a lot of actresses do today, they'd be all wrong.
Yeah, there were some extremely beautiful girls who came in where as soon as I sat down, I was just like, you're never going to play Betty Page. It's just all. And it was both the thinness, and actually with some people, it was their body language was all wrong. People would come in and flop and be all relaxed and, you know, the modern manner. But when Gretchen Mol came in, she had deportment. You know, she stood up straight and had her legs crossed. You know, she was like she's wearing white gloves, you know, at the same time that she's, you know, very, you know, adorable and sexy. But she had that, you know, 50s decorum. So there were two things I was looking at, both the right kind of body. I mean, Gretchen is slimmer than Betty. Betty was a curvaceous woman. But I felt like she had the body language so down that she could make it work.
Now, the movie shot, there are color sequences, but the movie's largely shot in black and white. So it looks very much of its era, the 1950s. Why did you want to shoot it in black and white?
Well, you know, I never knew why, really. It was just such a deeply held conviction. And many people, when we went and pitched the story, was like, why? And I have to. You know, the 50s in New York are black and white. I mean, that's certainly how I think of that era. But I realized after we made the film that, of course, the Paula Clough photos are in black and white. And the Bunny Yeager photos that she did in Miami are in color. So that was one reason why I just thought, yeah, New York, black and white. Miami color, because that's how I got to know Betty. But also, I think that there was a good reason for it that I wasn't able to articulate at the time, which was that it gives black and white gives those fetish scenes an aesthetic distance, you know, and also the nude scene. There's a scene with one of the camera clubs early on where she takes all her clothes off, and I want to be very beautiful and kind of not wink wink, you know, more like as she said, as Betty says, you know, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And having it in black and white makes it like another world, the past. And also, you know, to me, one of the main things I wanted to do with this movie was to take you back. I wanted it to be a journey into the past, if it did nothing else. And I think black and white helps to do that.
One of the things that makes the movie very convincing looking is that the faces of the actors and actresses, they look like 1950s faces. And I couldn't explain to you exactly what I mean by that, but they just do, and they're shot in a very 1950s kind of way. Could you talk a little bit about casting for faces that look right for the period?
Yeah, because I care a lot about casting, not just the main roles, but also the extras. And one reason why I was determined to shoot in New York rather than Vancouver or Toronto, which would be cheaper, was that I just don't think you can get New York faces there. I'm from Toronto, so, you know, it's just different. And the other thing I said was to our extras casting, no facial work, no plastic surgery, because that's not period. People in the 50s didn't have their faces done. And then it was really a question of the right faces and then our, you know, fantastic makeup. Our makeup artist, Nikki Lederman, who did such a great job. And then, you know, it was hair, wardrobe. You know, it's production design. But actually, in terms of just shooting the faces, Maud Hopfel, our DP, also used, you know, some period filters. We used a range of lenses that you would only use in 50s movies. There's no long lenses because those came later. We used the lighting of 50s movies, a lot of light, even in the outdoor sequences, to give it that kind of slightly hyper-real quality of old Hollywood. And then we, for Gresham, we also had a thing called the ring light, which is the old Hollywood way of lighting actresses. Because I wanted her always to be like, in an old Hollywood movie, the star is always almost like has a light on her. She's always like glowing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we used an old Hollywood trick, which is a ring light around the camera to cast this even glow on her. So there's a lot went into it.
Do you think that your film, The Notorious Betty Page, has a slightly different point of view with you shooting it as a woman than the point of view that a man shooting it would be likely to have? Is that a fair question?
Oh, yeah. I think it's undoubtedly true. In some ways, I feel it's like the whole point of it. Because I approached her, I think, in a different way. I was not so interested in her being sexy. You know, that wasn't my... I was interested in what it's like to be that kind of girl. What it is like to be a beauty queen. What it is like to be the object of that, you know, that much attention or that gaze. Or, you know, what's it like when your face, your body changes your life in that way? And then what was it for her? What was her experience? That was really... I was just like, you know, let's take her life, her point of view. And I feel like there have been lots of things about beauty icons, but they're not really from their... point of view. It's not about what life is like for them.
You know, as mysterious as it seems, why would somebody be into bondage imagery, you know, and images of women being tied up? I think it's fair to say that, say, in 1950s Westerns, that kind of bondage imagery was a stock part of Westerns. Women were always getting kidnapped and tied up. And, I mean, you could easily argue that 50s Westerns, which children grew up on and everybody watched, were kind of covert bondage imagery.
Yes, and I think Irvin Claw would definitely try to make that case, in fact, in his legal battles. And how that whole business of the Claws came about was that they noticed that people would come in and ask for, you know, Tarzan and the Slave Girl, you know, that photo of her being tied up. That images of women being bound and tied up were very, very popular. And so they realized that there was a special market. I guess they started to specialize and order more, focus on it. And then what's complicated about it is you can see why men, you know, it's dominance of submission. You can see why certain men with kind of S&M tendencies would want to see women bound up. That would play to that fantasy. But then there's also like the female end of it. And I think that Betty Page's popularity kind of reveals the complexity of sexual fantasy, you know, that people imagine themselves in different roles, you know. I mean, even John Willie, you know, the great perv, you know, he liked to be tied up too. He would wear women's stockings, you know. You think of him as, oh, if he likes to photograph women tied up, that means he's one kind of sexual animal. But no, he would wear silk stockings, high heels. He'd like to be, you know, he'd be tied up himself. And people are complicated.
Were there things that you learned about fetishism and different tastes in fetishism that you found just either baffling or fascinating or like, who knew? You know, like, who knew that there was a cult around this item?
Well, actually, years ago was when I first started to hear about this, when I was a young journalist in London. And a friend of mine gave me copies of a British fetish magazine called Atomage, and which was the magazine for vinyl and leather fetishes, and which was hilarious. It was even funnier than the Claws in some ways because it was written from a real English hobbyist's standpoint. It was all about the care and preservation of your leather and vinyl. And it was like they were talking about gardening. It was so British and sort of banal and suburban because, of course, all this stuff is rampant in suburban homes as opposed to, like, you know, supposedly the evil metropolis. I'm sure you probably find that today in America. But anyway, they had the strangest things, which would be like people having fetishes for rubber boots, Wellington boots, and people having fetishes for gas masks, which in – this was many years ago that I looked into this magazine. But this was a kind of a post-war thing, that there were all these people that had somehow childhood experiences during the Blitz in Britain with putting on gas masks, and somehow it became a fetish. It's that was the strangest thing I ever encountered. It's like, all right, I would never have thought of that.
Really?
you know, it's like, okay. So anything, you know, anything can somehow become, as they say in the Senate hearings that we, you know, recreate, anything can become a fetish, even a violin. But actually with the claws, you know, with the world of Betty Page, I wasn't really looking that much into fetishism because I wasn't really dealing with the fetishists. I was dealing with the people who create the product. And it's kind of like any kind of filming or any kind of photography. It's like all very – it's a job, you know? And those people – the people who create those sexy images aren't doing it in a sort of atmosphere of sexiness, eroticism. You know, they're just like, okay, you know, well, we need these kind of photographs, 12 copies of this and 8-inch high heels and, you know, move that light and we have to be finished by 5:30.
Betty Page is still alive. Do you know what she's doing now?
Well, she's 83 and I think quite frail. She spends a lot of time signing the many photographs that people, you know, photographs and memorabilia, which she is now able to get some, you know, money out of. She did see the film. It was shown to her at the Playboy Mansion with Hugh Hefner, who was a friend of hers.
What'd she say about it?
Well, I think she liked Gretchen. I think she enjoyed it. I think she found it, you know, when I thought about it, it's like, oh, seeing a film of your own life, it would be so weird and annoying, really, because it's never going to be how you remember it. Because to the point where she said, I wasn't wearing a purple dress. I didn't say that, you know, and I don't blame her. You know, you weren't. You know, it was just we thought that up. So I think she's still processing it. I think she enjoyed it except for the Senate hearings, which I think is still a painful subject.
Even though she didn't have to testify at them.
Well, I think it was more what people said about her that she found painful.
What did they say about her at the Senate hearings?
Well, she was used as an example of that, you know, there's this whole thing towards the end of the film where someone, you know, it's a very tragic story that is from the actual transcripts of those hearings where a young boy was found dead, strangled who tied himself up in ropes. And I believe, and clearly the police then felt that it was autoerotic asphyxiation because they refused to pursue it as a criminal case. But the boy's father was so, you know, racked with grief that he thought, no, it can't have been. It must have been somebody did this to my son. And he found someone showed him some photographs of Betty Page in which she was tied up in a kind of similar pose, and I assume in some classic bondage pose. And these became part of the Senate hearings when they said, you know, this photograph must have caused this boy's death. So it was very, I think, upsetting to her.
So you mentioned that Betty Page is friends with Hugh Hefner and she saw your film at the Playboy Mansion. Is she still very religious?
Betty is still religious. Of course, she always was. That was one of the things that first intrigued me about her was that knowing that she was a girl from Nashville who'd been brought up in that kind of Southern religious background, I always thought that she would never have not been religious. You know, she may have been more or less involved with God and more or less involved with the church, but it wasn't like she didn't ever believe in God, you know. But what's interesting about Betty was that she combined her religiousness with an extraordinary kind of free thinking, really. Because even today, she looks back on her pinup career and says, I'm not ashamed of what I did, you know. So people take from religion, you know, people personalize their religion, I think, more than we'd like to acknowledge. And people take what means something to them. And I think she was not interested in Puritan morality. She wasn't interested in telling other people what to do. You know, I think at heart she was a very tolerant person. She was an open-minded person. And when she went to God, it was more as a refuge and also I think, being born again, you know, the personal knowledge of Jesus. And after she was born again and attended Bible school. As far as I know, she didn't go around preaching and saying, you know, I have left my sinful life behind. Someone who was in her Bible class who said that he didn't even know much about her previous career. So I think she, you know, so she seems to combine it with the Playboy Mansion and church going, you know, without any big sense of contradiction.
Well, Mary Harron, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Mary Harron directed the new film, The Notorious Betty Page.